the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the place where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, Brains.
Coming to you straight from San Diego, California, let's welcome our host, April Mahoney.
And I was dancing with one of my colleagues. I said, all my colleagues were white, bar one, but my black colleague wasn't there at that night. And as we finished dancing, I walked off the dance floor, and I then learned that one of my colleagues had been called an N-lover from another officer from another station. And I remember they'd been told to sit down, and there was so much tension in the air where suddenly my station, Vine Street, and Holborn, there was like a them and us. And ever since that time, my team for my first 2 years that I worked with, they were so protective of me. I think then they realized that there were other people who, you know, all did the same job, resented the fact that I was there. So I was protected by my team very much.
That's wonderful. You know, and again, it's all about the education and the sensitivity. When people touch you, they feel you, they smell you, look like you smell so good. You know, but again, they know that the blood that's running through your veins is warm. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that separates you from them is the color of your skin, and you have no control over that.
Well, exactly. But it's a shame.
Running for them.
Yeah. And it's a shame that there was just so many, you know, people who didn't work with me closely, just didn't understand or didn't want to understand me. There was one officer in my first month. We had to go out walking with more experienced officers. And my sergeant would always try to make sure that I had a variety of people to walk with. So on this particular day, I walked with this officer and he didn't speak to me. He didn't say, Jenny, he didn't call my name. He didn't say come, he didn't say go. We walked the streets for 8 hours and we did nothing. He didn't talk to me. He didn't even look in my direction. And I realized we were going back to the station at some point because I thought, okay, I recognize this bit. We got back to the station. He went to have his food, ordered his lunch. And when I went to sit near him, he got up and moved elsewhere. And then I just sat there. And then after, when he's finished eating, I realized he got up, picked up his hat, picked up his coat, and he started to walk out the station. And then I followed him like a little puppy. And I remember at the end of the shift, I spoke to my sergeant and said, please, can I not work with him again? I said, he didn't speak to me. But there was no one you can report things to, because I knew that if I reported anything to...
They were all the same.
Yeah, exactly.
They were all the same, ignorant.
Yeah.
Okay, so fast forward. So things progressed as you worked in the police department, more women, more people of color. How did you see things change? And from your experience, how were you able to impact some of those changes?
Right, well, things started in maybe 90, because at training school, there was another class that had two black guys. And so we were forming already our own little, you know, community. And so we had a few people that we knew. So, you know, there weren't many black officers out of nearly 30,000 at that point in 1990. This is a few years after I joined. The records say there was about 400 black and minority officers in the whole of the Met. Actually, by the end of 90, it's nearly 500. But what was happening, a lot of black officers were leaving in droves. So the Met was really worried that they were going to lose all their, you know, diverse staff. So we were all sent to Bristol, this place up north, I don't know the area, but we all sent to Bristol. We didn't have any choice, but we had to go, and they wanted us to speak freely to these facilitators to talk about our experiences. And I mean, that was really cathartic, actually, to actually share your experiences and the stuff that had been, you know, happening. And it's all black officers. And then after that, that evening, we all went out sort of partying, and it was fabulous. It was just nice. But that was the beginnings of the Black Police Association, which I was one of the former founder members of. So we started saying, well, you know, there's obviously a need to have a support group. We started off as a support group. And I mean, there was a lot of opposition. Absolutely. People said, well, why do you need to have a separate group? Right. You've already got a federation.
What are you guys going to be talking about? What are you going to be conspiring about? You know, it's like, we want love. We want support. We want someone to look like us. We want someone that's had our experience. We want someone that knows how to talk to people in our community. Because see, here in the United States, you know, the white police officer will put his knee on your neck, choke you out until you're dead, you know, or instead of, again, like me, you know, trying to aim for your shoulder or your knee, they go straight for your heart and your head. They kill you and they load up rounds. We just had an incident here where they went into the woman's house on a drug raid. Wrong house. She's standing there butt naked. But you know, you've got the wrong house. This is not who you need. So was there any accountability, you know, in the long term for these officers? Were there any training for the white officers? You know, because it was not just, okay, so you had black and white. What other minorities were there in the police officers?
Oh, we didn't have a wide range. Black, Asian, and then now we're having some officers who are from sort of Turkish backgrounds, Polish. So it is starting to become a mix. When we're talking about visible.
I mean, when you look at, when you say Turkish and Polish, mm-hmm. they're still white Europeans. I mean, did you have a mix of Asians? Did you have people from India? Did you have people from, I don't know, Mexican or Spaniards, anything like that?
Yeah, we have had some, well, Spanish, we had some. I don't know any Mexican officers, me personally. I don't. But there is a mix. I mean, I can't categorically say what we have, but... yeah, we do have sort of, you know, people from Bangladesh, Pakistan, parts of India.
Because I'm just wondering, I say that because, okay, you had this experience, you had this revelation as a black woman, but what are these other minorities feeling? Because they're subjected to racism based upon their culture, their heritage, their look, the same thing. So they're feeling isolated. And I'm really hoping that, you know, if there's just a small spackling of them, that the Black Police Officers Association will reach out to them.
No, absolutely. Yeah, no, that was one of the arguments we were having when we were trying to form the name. You know, what was it going to be called? Is it going to be called minority ethnic? But part of the Constitution was the fact that Black was encompassing everyone who was different. Now we have other associations which are more specific, like the Jewish Association. But at the time, it was, you know, anyone who was from a diverse background. So that was, you know, to encompass everyone. So
now you do this. You do this for the Black Association. What about women? How were, you know, I'm sure that that's tough, being a woman in that environment. Was there camaraderie between female officers, or they too looked at the color of your skin first before the content of your heart?
No, absolutely. Initially, because obviously the women were having their own sort of issues being second class in the Met. And I had there were some officers, female, who were not kind. And I know it's because of my color. The most ridiculous thing, I remember there was a couple of officers at my first station, not on my team, and I joined the netball team. And the most ridiculous thing, we're on the same team playing netball, and they wouldn't throw the ball to me. I just didn't think, this is just so ridiculous. You know, that's how far it got. And then there was another thing with other women. Frankly, I didn't have that myself, but I know there were other women then being unkind to other female officers because they were jealous. I just had it because I was black. I didn't feel that they were jealous.
It wasn't just because you were black, Jenny. Mm-hmm. Because you were black, you were beautiful, you were smart, you were courageous, you were good at what you did, and they were jealous, mm-hmm. and they were envious, and they were insecure, and they felt threatened. Okay, yeah. That's for you. Or any other brain out there that's got an issue. Okay, that's what that's about. It's not about just the color of our skin, because surprisingly enough, there's a lot of people out there that really envy us for who we are and where we've come from and the ability to overcome. You know, that's like here in the United States, we had all of these riots over the George Floyd killing. And, you know, Black Lives Matter. They got an issue with Black Lives Matter. Well, we coined the phrase. We stand up for who we are, Black Power, Black Panthers. Because again, that's what you're judging us upon is our Blackness. And if we were really these barbarians and these beasts that people fear and think that we are, honestly, we should have had this handled. But that is not who we are. We are kind, loving people. We are God-fearing people. We are indigenous people. We are the first people. I don't care, brains. You can get mad at me if you want to, okay? It's the truth. tell the truth and shame the devil right here on the edge, okay? Because I'm going to tell you how it is, okay? Now, that's not to say that we're better, but that is not to say that we are less than, equal to, or greater than in some situations. And it's very, very hard to keep having to fight the same fight. We don't have any control over this.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's ignorance. It's ignorance. It's not knowing. All right. So now you've created this great program. You've got your colleagues involved. Tell us where you are today with working with, because I know that you still have a foundation or a program. Tell us a little bit about that and what the work is that you're doing now to kind of, you know, equal the playing field and get the ball thrown to you.
Well, since retiring, I took a couple of years out just to reset myself and support my family. And I have been conducting talks in schools, sort of education talks, talking about my journey, talking about being in the police service. It's very much I'm wanting to get the younger generation to maybe consider that as a career. But what I'm actually doing also is, I'm now an associate for this organisation, that we help women and people from diverse backgrounds practice the interviewing process to join the police if they wish to.
Oh, okay.
So that's what we're actually doing. Because if you've not had any background at all about the policing, and the whole structure is changed to get in, so your first time you go in to apply for the service, you've got this competency-based interview. Now it's all online because of COVID, and it's totally alien to you. So it's all about just getting them to think sort of differently, so that the time when they do go for their real-time interview, that they have a better chance of being successful first time.
Was there a pay differentiator? Did you get paid differently than your white colleagues or other?
No. That's probably one of the only jobs that you get paid the same. There was one particular rate. I mean, there was one time when women were getting paid more because we were paying less pension, but then there was an uproar about that, and then we had to sort of get that in line. But no, the pay is the same throughout the actual ranks.
Okay. Yeah. Two things. The first thing, thank you so much for wearing your lapel pin.
Absolutely, yes.
Great. And secondly, I want to send my deepest condolences to your family for the loss of your mom from COVID-19. Tell us a little bit about that experience, only because that's the sign of the times, as much as you want to share. So people are aware that it is real. They don't believe that it's real. How it's impacting minority communities. How, you know, is there hope? Is there fear? You know, what did you go through?
At the beginning of the lockdown, the first initial lockdown, I was feeling really fearful, very fearful, because I have a condition called sarcoidosis, which affects my lungs. My younger sister, who is a serving police officer also, is a chronic asthmatic. I mean, our conditions have never stopped us doing what we, you know, our jobs. But suddenly COVID hit, and that possibility of, oh my gosh. My mother was in a care home, and you know, she's 89. She was feisty, very strong. You know, she'll tell you what for, you know. She had dementia, but, you know, she was eating well. And then suddenly we got a phone call in the middle of April to say that she wasn't well, because we were no longer able to go to visit her. But we were having FaceTime conversations, and obviously receiving this call, I was concerned, we were all concerned. So we did have a FaceTime call with the nurse so that we can actually see our mum. The next day, a doctor saw her via FaceTime and said that she thought she had pneumonia. Didn't really accept that. So I thought, hold on, pneumonia. You know, she'd already recovered from pneumonia the year before. You know, she's very strong. She had a stroke a couple of years before that and totally recovered from that. Really strong woman. And within basically sort of hours, we were told that the doctor told us that he believed it was COVID. The home was denying that. They said they didn't think they didn't have any COVID. But she'd been given two sets of antibiotics. And the following Tuesday, we then got told that she'd worsened. She was going to see a doctor again. Doctor saw her again. We were told in the morning that she was responding well to the antibiotics. And I was beginning to think, oh, gosh, a bit of hope. And then lunchtime, we got a phone call, said she died. And that, you know, up to now, I don't really think that I actually accept that she's gone, or my sisters. It's been such a weird experience because we never saw her again. You know, she was put in a body bag in her nightie and her bag was sealed and we had never seen her mum again. The next time I was in the presence of my mum was at her own funeral, and we attended. There's only five of us. We can only have 11, but we only had five of us attend. And it was a coffin with my mum's name in it. And it's very difficult. I actually cried. I think I cried for 10 minutes initially, but then it doesn't seem real. And then I cried. Sadly, we had a tragic murder in September of a colleague who happened to be a good friend of mine. He was murdered on duty. And I think the combination of that and then with my mum, I think I had about 4 days when I just needed to just bawl on my own.
You needed to decompress. You need to process it. And, you know, grief is a process. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, it's a way to cope. It's not to get over. It's not to forget. It's a way to cope. It's a way to adjust. But what has that taught you personally about living and dying and your own immortality?
It's made me really think about what's important. What's important, my family. It made me think about all the stuff that you don't need that. Made me think about, you know, connecting to those people that you know, you haven't, you know, instead of putting stuff off, you need to sort of, you know, think in the moment sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the whole situation has made me waste less. I mean, seriously, so many different things. Yeah, think about my family more. What's so much so important?
You know, it's taught me to reflect. Mm-hmm. It's taught me to, I think about my family and what they've done. But I think about who I am and what I've done and what legacy and what imprint I want to leave on this planet and what I want people to think about me and say about me and the good works and good deeds that I am still able to do. You know, I've made peace with my God. I know that sounds odd, but again, you know, people are running around getting a test. Just because you get a test doesn't mean that's just telling you if you're positive or negative. Yeah. Yeah. That's not a way of, you know, alienating you or, you know, you dodging the bullet. We've got a vaccine. Again, Black people of color, period, are very skeptical because we've been used as, you know, test dummies before. Oh, okay, let's inject them. And if, you know, they're the indigenous people, remember, they're the first people on the earth. And if they survive it, well, then by golly, George, you know, now we'll go ahead and take it, you know? So it's some trickery. And I hit people to the trickery all the time. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about if I'm going to take it. I'm going to wait. You know, I'm sure I'm going to have to wait. Yeah. But it's a money game too. You know, who's got it? It's three different big pharma companies.
Yeah.
I'm not discouraging people because I'm not a physician. And I want people to, you know, get involved in science and research because that is where our DNA is different. And we need to definitely know what's going to work with us and what's going to work with other people so that we can survive. But what happens here in the United States is they take away your health care. So even if there is a vaccine,
yeah,
you can't get to the doctor to get it. So it's one thing after another. Yeah. So now you're writing a book. Tell us what's going to be in the pages of your book and what is that about?
Well, my book is about my experiences. It was going to be about the first 5 years. But I've decided to extend it throughout, you know, for the majority of my service. So it's going to be a story about what's going to be. I've nearly finished the first draft. So it's about me, about resilience and how, it's about, you know, my time in the service and how I overcame things, about resilience, about being determined to do. You know, you have a plan that you're going to complete what you're going to do. So, again, it's a bit about sort of, you know, my family life as well. So, it's...
Well, that's beautiful because you've got a lot of stories. So we've talked about some heavy stuff. Let's play a round of a few questions. Let me ask you some random questions, okay? See what you're going to say. What, Officer Donaldson? Is that what they call you? Or you called your Bobby? What do they call you there in London, police?
Well, it would, be officer. But before I left, my colleagues, my staff would call me Mom because I was an inspector.
Oh, okay. See? Yeah, you went from sloppy seconds to now being the mother of everyone. You better watch that, brains. All right, so if you were an animal, what animal would you be and why?
Oh, gosh, I'd have to be, I'm a cat lover. I love cats. I'd probably have to be a big cat. I'd have to be a female. I'd have to be a female lioness because I love the way how that they come together as a group. Then they work together, you know, and when they're all together, that there is no man, no massive lion that can overtake them when they work together. That's what I love.
Okay.
That pride of lions, lionesses.
You know what animal I would be?
Which one?
I'd be a party animal. For real. All right. What's your favorite color and why?
Ooh, my favorite color would be red. And because number one, red is a really good color for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's passion. It used to be blue, but I've changed my my outlook. Red, when I'm wearing red, I feel like there's nothing that I can't do.
It's a power.
My
favorite color is green.
Mm-hmm.
You'll always see a black line of green. I love green. That's a power color as well. A lot of energy.
Yes.
So what are two things that you just absolutely cannot live without?
Oh, my word. Well, two things. One thing that I normally wear every day is mascara. I know it seems a bit sort of... because I've noticed I've got a couple of great... I've got a great eyelash in each of my eyes. One right in the middle.
Oh, God. Is that the worst thing that you could have?
I know. What I can't live without. Well, that's definitely one. I can't think of another one. Because I know some people say their phones or something like that. And
unless you didn't say that.
No, but...
Unless you didn't say that. Because that device is a killer.
Yeah. I mean, I can put mine in the other room. It's fine. I have forgotten it and gone out and I thought, I've forgotten it. I'll get back. And it hasn't rang.
What music do you like?
Sorry? Music? Mm-hmm. I'm quite eclectic. I like all kinds of stuff. I like R&B. I like garage. A bit of classical if I really want to sort of, you know, do a bit of studying, all kinds of music. I don't have one particular. I like a bit of lover's rock. Yes, you know, I mean, that was my era growing up, very much lover's rock and a bit of R&B and, you know, a bit of slow dancing type stuff. But I love salsa. I used to do a bit of salsa dancing as well. Love it.
I know, I love that too. That's a Latin influence.
Yes.
What's your favorite meal?
Chinese food. I mean, I love sort of like traditional Caribbean food. Chinese food, I have it on sort of tap. But one of my favorite, what my mum used to make, was roti and curry. Like how Guyanese people make it, roti and curry and dal puri and all that. Ah, oh,
So yeah.
I can eat it now.
Okay. And so let me ask you this final question, Jenny. When you meet our creator in heaven, and he says, "Well done, my child," what is going to be your response? How are you going to want to be remembered? And what is he thanking you for? What have you done well at?
I think you'd thank me for bringing up my boys with respect and having grace for people. And being of service. I've always liked to be of service to help people. I think those are the main things, you know, to bring up my kids. I'm not one of those people, I'm not a type of a warring person at all. I would rather have a discussion and explain. There's nothing that bad we can't discuss. But I would always like to think that I've always done my best to help people. I've always, you know, been of service and brought my boys up to respect, you know, the fellow human beings.
Well, I think that you're an amazing lioness with beautiful long lashes without a gray one in there, that looks Chinese food, that has a red mane and a heart of gold, and you're a great mother. And thank you so much for being here on the edge. Where's my phone card? Right here. On the edge. On the place where we are connecting people, we're protecting people, and we're serving our community, no matter what color you are. If you need help, we've got people like Jenny that's willing to help you. You got people like me that's willing to communicate and facilitate. So Brains, go in and subscribe right now. I need you to subscribe to the YouTube channel and listen to other edgy conversations, because they're important. And we go to the people's heart. You know, these people that I bring on the show are not here just for shit and giggles. They're here because they care, they want to communicate, they want to resonate in your heart, they want to make a difference, because they have learned the art of resilience. Thank you so much for being here on the edge with me, Jenny. I think you're wonderful, and I'm looking forward to that book, okay? Let me know, give me the exclusive, so I want to hear all about it, and I want to be the first one to have the opportunity to release that for you, okay?
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me on your show, thank you.
All right, bye, baby.
Okay, take care.